so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Trita Parsi. He's the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, an organization that he co-founded and is the president is Andrew Bacevich, a well-known scholar and foreign policy expert. They have created what I think is one of the most extraordinary institutes and challenges that has the potential to do great benefit to public policy. And in this context of the pandemic, climate change, tumultuous politics, U.S.-China relations, I don't think there's a better place to, how do I say, put a bookmark on your website than the Quincy Institute, because they come from a very deep ethical place, and they do a great deal of very, very sophisticated work related to American foreign policy, which, as you all know, has tremendous consequences for our fiscal capacity, budget, issues, priorities, and our ability to meet challenges and act according to the principles upon which the country was founded. Trita, thanks for joining me. This is really great to be able to speak
to you. Thank you so much for having me.
And Trita, I know you've done a lot of work. You're from Iran. You've done a lot of work in the context of Iran. You've written some very interesting books. I think before you and I met, I had a book of yours called Treacherous Alliance about secret dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. And I remember seeing some notification about it at the Council on Foreign Relations. And so I ended up, being curious and grabbing a copy and being glad I did. And then we met years later. I know your latest book called Losing an Enemy, about the Obama administration, its relationship to Iran, which I haven't read, but it had a lot to do with some of the nuclear deal that was reached and then some of the, reversals that took place following the election of Donald Trump. But most recently, I've read about how sanctions are being used, I guess the special envoy or representative Elliot Abrams is often accused of implementing these, and how the Iranians are suffering tremendously from the sanctions, particularly related to response to the pandemic COVID-19. Can you shed a little bit of light on what's happening with U.S.-Iran and that particular question of the sanctions and health?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure being on this podcast with you. The situation between the United States and Iran has been quite depressing for the last couple of years. A major breakthrough was found through the nuclear deal. It was a huge diplomatic win and achievement. I mean, it's one of the first cases in which you have that type of a multilateral diplomacy resolving an issue that virtually was on the brink of war and doing so without a single shot being fired. But the Trump administration reversed it, exited the deal, and then reimposed sanctions, and then went way beyond that in what they themselves call maximum pressure or economic warfare. They have tried to completely collapse the Iranian economy while curiously claiming that one can collapse an economy of another country without imposing any suffering on the people of that country, which is, of course, complete nonsense. The evolution of sanctions in the United States is something that I think is quite interesting. And I suspect that we're at an inflection point in which more and more political voices are being raised against the use of economic sanctions, or at least this excessive use of it, precisely because it has proven to be the opposite of what it was promised to be. It was promised to be an alternative to war. The belief that sanctions almost would eliminate the need for war because through economic pressure, the objectives could be achieved without people having actually being killed. Reality is that sanctions are just a different form of warfare, and they do kill. They kill a tremendous amount of people through the poverty and the destruction of societies that they do create. In the case of Iran, the Trump administration intensified sanctions after COVID because they saw COVID as a multiplier of the sanctions impact that they were looking for, which is in many ways an admission of the cruelty behind sanctions. Let me give you one example of how sanctions actually do destroy societies. In 2004, the State Department conducted an internal study trying to explain why it was so difficult to govern Iraq after the invasion of that country. One chapter is devoted to sanctions, and it points out that after almost a decade of really cruel sanctions imposed by the US and the United Nations, the Iraqi economy had shrunk to no more than $16 billion. And that had then changed the incentive structure of ordinary individuals to the point in which people stopped sending their girls to school because there was no economy for the girls to be active in afterwards. And as a result, you ended up having an increase in female illiteracy in Iraq. And Iraq historically has been one of the best educated Arab countries. Now you tell me, after increasing the illiteracy of women in a country, what are the prospects of that country being able to move in a democratic direction? Is that one of the building blocks of a democracy to actually render the situation for women much, much worse? And the State Department itself pointed to that as one of the reasons why it was so difficult to govern the country afterwards, precisely because sanctions had destroyed so many of the building blocks of that society, building blocks that are needed in order to move in a democratic direction. We have now seen, after decades of sanctions on Cuba, on Venezuela, and other countries, that the success rate of sanctions are extremely, extremely low. There's only one example that oftentimes is invoked, and that is South Africa. And those are under very, very different circumstances. The element that has been neglected and not enough attention been paid to is the connection between sanctions and the lack of democratization. And that's something that I've worked a little bit on, taking a look at the number of countries that have been under embargo-like sanctions and how many of those actually have transitioned to democracy. And the picture is extremely bleak. There's essentially 10 countries that have been under these type of embargo types of sanctions. Only one of them transitioned towards democracy. All others became more repressive. The economic situation became more intolerable for the individuals, and the governments oftentimes ended up becoming more adventurous externally. So all of the things we say we don't want to achieve is what we are most likely to achieve with sanctions. And that is exactly what is happening with Iran as well. And that is not even taking account the human suffering that the sanctions are causing.
I think the question of, how would I say, the use of sanctions to destroy the basis for women and therefore future mothers to become educated as citizens and as nurturers of the next generation is, how would I say, that's a violent crime. And it's not consistent with the kind of principles this country espouses to inspire its own citizens.
The thinking here, I think, is starting to change a little bit in the sense that sanctions had the image of being this nonviolent way of putting pressure on countries that were doing bad things, to now increasingly being seen as an act of violence in and of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I guess the idea, like you said, the idealistic notion of sanctions is it's something other than weapons, but it also presumes that the government inside the country is responsive to alleviating the stresses that the sanctions impose on certain segments of the population. And that implies which might call a coherence of representation that may or may not exist.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the ironies here, sanctions actually most likely are most effective on democracies precisely because they have governments that are somewhat responsive to the population. Whereas in dictatorships where you don't have that type of relationship, all it ends up doing is to put a lot of pressure on the civil society and ordinary people without them having the ability to pressure their government to change their policies in order to alleviate the sanctions.
When you saw that, what you call that great achievement of the Obama administration, what was the basis of why it was relinquished? What broke it down and had it rescinded when we changed presidency? How was that rationalized? How was that justified?
Well, different story as to how it was rationalized and, of course, and why it took place in the first place. But I think the way the Trump administration rationalized it was by claiming that this deal actually made it more likely that the Iranians would get nuclear weapons and that it was unfair to the United States in many different ways. And you know, the scientific community is completely clear on some of these issues. This was a deal that had the support of all of the countries in the UN Security Council, essentially only three countries that opposed the deal. That was Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Three countries that incidentally also were the ones that were in favor of the United States going to war with Iran. And we know also now, of course, that the belief that this actually would lead to an Iranian nuclear weapon has been proven untrue. On the contrary, the most likely scenario for the Iranians to go nuclear is exactly what Trump did. He walked out of the deal, which then enabled the Iranians to reduce their obligations to the deal, even though they haven't walked out of it, which then created a scenario in which the ability for the Iranians to expand the nuclear program and actually get a nuclear option is much, much more likely without these restrictions. And one of the most important elements of the nuclear deal was that it imposed on the Iranians transparency measures that ensured that there essentially was nothing they could do within their program that wouldn't be that wouldn't come to the attention to the International Atomic Energy Agency very, very quickly. And in fact, part of the reason why the United States knows so much about the nuclear program right now is precisely because of the inspections regime that the JCPOA put in place. You take that out and suddenly the nuclear program becomes a black box, which is much, much more dangerous than the situation we're faced with right now. The real reason, I think, as to why Trump did this is because he just had this obsession of undoing everything that was part of Obama's legacy. The real reason for some of the people that supported him in doing so, the countries that supported him, is precisely because they did not want to see this issue resolved. It's not that they were worried about the issue. They were worried that the issue would get resolved, because if the issue got resolved, it meant that the United States and Iran would be able to move towards resolving their other problems as well, and eventually, potentially even having good relations. The United States and Iran having good relations would dramatically shift and alter the geopolitical picture in the Middle East. It would create a scenario that the Israelis worried about, which because they were worried that under those circumstances, the United States and Iran would perhaps have start to have good or neutral relations, whereas Israel itself would continue to have a contentious relationship with Iran, but now without the automatic backing and support of the United States. The Saudis and the UAE had a very similar concern. They've been enjoying a balance of power in the region because of the U.S.'s military presence in the region, in which the U.S. is essentially putting its finger on the scale and pushing it in favor of the Saudis and the UAE. They would never be able to establish this balance on their own because they don't have the power to do so. If the U.S. and Iran actually were to improve their relations, it would enable the United States to have more opportunities to reduce its military footprint in the region, bring the troops home as a very large number of Americans wants, and potentially shift its focus to other geopolitical problems elsewhere. This would be a disaster from their perspective, because then they would have to actually engage in their own diplomacy with Iran and agree to painful concessions and compromises that they prefer not to engage with, which they don't have to engage with as long as the U.S. is there and essentially providing them with a security umbrella. So for those reasons, they did everything they could to prevent Obama to reach the deal and then later on to convince Trump to walk out of the deal. And right now, they're doing everything they can to make a Biden re-entry into the deal as difficult as possible.
Yeah. On that note, what do you anticipate with regard to Biden and re-entry to that deal? Does that look like, a likely scenario, or is it remote for some of the reasons that you'd be aware of?
I think the Biden administration has fully understood the tremendous need for the U.S. to go back into the deal. And I think they're doing the right thing by pursuing what is called the compliance for compliance. The U.S. just starts to comply with the nuclear deal once again, given that the Iranians also honor all of their obligations. And from there on, new conversations can begin on other issues or on issues that perhaps need to be redefined with the nuclear deal. But it's going to be done from the standpoint of the U.S. actually be a country that is in good standing with the deal. That part, I suspect, is not terribly difficult. I mean, there's going to be a lot of opposition to it from Israel and Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But nevertheless, I think it is doable. Afterwards, I think there's going to be some other headaches because there's going to be an effort to renegotiate parts of the deal, also start negotiations on other issues. And those are going to be very, very tricky. And I think will very much depend on whether the Biden administration adopts a position of trying to use its power to advance the Saudi position in those negotiations, or if its focus is going to be on its own national interests and then acting as a facilitator to help resolve the problems between these different regional countries rather than actually being a belligerent in that conflict. I mean, part of the problem with the U.S.'s Middle East policy is that we've gotten so close to some of these strategic partners, so we are now deeply involved in their conflicts and their rivalries that actually have very little bearing on U.S. national interest.
I can see the lens through which you're describing this. Having come from Iran, you did a PhD in at SAIS at Johns Hopkins, the School of International Relations there. And I understood from our earlier conversation, you've also done a master's degree in economics, which, connects to our listeners. What
I did. Inspired... I got a degree at the Stockholm School of Economics in Sweden.
Let me ask, what inspired the founding of the Quincy Institute? What's the genesis of that creation?
The Quincy Institute came about for the very simple reason that several of us felt that there was a major conceptual deficit in our foreign policy thinking. That we were now faced with a world that was very, very different, yet we were pursuing a foreign policy as if nothing had changed. And seeing that Washington simply was not capable of thinking outside of the box, its institutions were designed not to do that, and that there was a need for completely new, fresh thinking in this regard. I mean, you know, we founded Quincy right, you know, a year before Quincy. We launched just a couple of months before COVID, but COVID in many ways became what validated the need for this fresh thinking. Because right now, we're dealing with more than one 9/11 amount of deaths per day as a result of COVID in this country. Yet more than $800 billion of American taxpayers' money spent on the Pentagon has been able to do absolutely nothing to deal with that threat. And that threat, this kind of common shared threat, together with climate chaos, is also a common shared threat, is the new type of threats that the United States and other countries in the world will be facing in this century, much more so than threats from other nation states. Yet our entire foreign policy, our budgets, our Pentagon structure is still geared towards dealing with threats from other countries, rather than dealing with these planetary challenges. And even after COVID, it's still very visible how the structure of the budgets, et cetera, are. We talk a lot about climate change, about pandemics, but it is not reflected in our actual decision-making. And this is part of the reason why we created COVID. We created Quincy, because we felt that it's so critical to bring in this new thinking, to readjust and shift our foreign policy away from what we have done in the past, which incidentally has begotten us all of these endless wars, and towards a completely new vision that looks at the United States and the challenges the world is facing right now, and thinks about how the U.S. should position itself in the world in such a manner that it does not need to, it really should not, seek to dominate every corner of the globe militarily, because that approach, that policy has begotten us these endless wars, and it has made America less safe because it's shifted our focus away from the real challenges of this century.
Yeah, I think I shared with you recently that I made a three-part video with the famous whistleblower and defense analyst, military analyst, Daniel Ellsberg. And Ellsberg has recently written a book called The Doomsday Machine. And at some level, exposed because of findings in the 1980s about a thing he called the nuclear winter and other things, that the risk of a command and control error or the risk of a renegade or whatever could lead to something which could, for all intents and purposes, exterminate life on Earth. And as he said, in the aftermath of the Cold War, there is no need for the scale of weapons on both sides. And he digs in the book to the political economy of what you might call orders and jobs and profits and lobbying and all of the things that, how would I say, refract our budgetary decisions from being for a wholesome social purpose. And all the time that I was listening to him, I kept hearing in my echoes in my mind of conversations you and I had had after we got acquainted, I think through our mutual friend Guy Saperstein. And but I listened to him, and again listening to you today, there is the not thinking outside the box, and then there is what you might call in other words, habits of mind, like mutual assured destruction, etc. And by the way, Ellsberg does not advocate completely eliminating nuclear weapons. He believes to take them way down in scale and still use them as a deterrent. But secondly, besides outside the box, is this question of capture, refraction, that the motivation for large military procurement may have to do with the need of powerful interests, not the well-being of the American people, or for that matter, humankind. And I'm curious how you see, whether it's Ellsberg's argument or the role of political economy in the defense allocation process.
I haven't read his book, but you know, obviously he's putting finger on it. I mean, this is exactly what President Eisenhower warned about, that we have now a structure in our economy that is so dependent on the arms industry. And the arms industry has very cleverly made sure that almost every major defense item or weapons structure right now, system, is produced in as many different congressional districts as possible. And as a result, has created a scenario in which if you try to actually reduce the budget, or if you want to cancel out systems, the argument immediately becomes, well, you're going to lose jobs in your district as a result of that. And that has become a major deterrent from preventing members of Congress to actually right-sizing the budget. I mean, most Americans have no clue that the United States has roughly 850 military bases around the world. The countries that are second on the list of having foreign military bases are France and Russia. They have 11 each. China, this big threat that is apparently going to take over the United States and force us to speak Mandarin, have 2 military bases. We have 850. The disproportion, the excessiveness of this is not just a problem. It's not just a waste of funds. It actually is making the United States less safe because it's entangling the United States in all kinds of conflicts abroad that have nothing to do with our national interests, actually prevents diplomacy from taking place to resolve those issues, while at the same time, we remain negligent of the real challenges that we are faced with in this century. And I don't know how many COVID and pandemics we need to have before Washington wakes up to this. This is a real problem. And if I could just go back to the region that I work with the most, one of the very welcome things that I think can come about after the JCPOA is add-on agreements that deals with conventional weapons in the region. And I know from the perspective of the Saudis, the UAE and the Israelis, they're very concerned about Iran's ballistic missile capabilities. And this is high up on the US's agenda as well. I think it would be totally legitimate to raise those issues and try to have a negotiation and try to find ways to restrict ballistic missiles and other weapon systems that are not WMDs. The challenge, however, is this. The Saudis are currently spending five times the amount of dollars on weapons imports than the Iranians are, or their military budget as a whole is more than five times the size of Iran's. The Emiratis are spending twice that much, the Israelis as well. The Iranians are completely outspent when it comes to this. The Saudis have missiles that are more accurate and have longer reach than those of the Iranians. And of course, the Israelis have nuclear weapons. I think it would be very valuable to talk about all of those different things, but that then causes us to run up to exactly what Ellsberg was pointing to. To actually get a real deal on those issues and restrict the capabilities of the Iranians would also then necessitate reducing American weapon sales to these GCC countries. Is the United States willing to give up those arms sales in order to actually be able to reach an agreement that could stabilize the Middle East? That proposition has never been tested because we never even have gotten that far. I hope we do. And then I think it will be quite clear the kind of choices we have to make, because we are not making ourselves any safe or the region any more safe by pouring this amount of weapons into that region.
I'm hearing the echoes of my late friend Chalmers Johnson, who wrote a wonderful trilogy, including books Nemesis and Blowback, about the consequences for the well-being of the American people, not only for the opportunity cost of where resources are spent, but from making, which I say, the world more dangerous and inviting, as he called in Blowback, retaliation against the United States for pain inflicted elsewhere. Do you think that at the high levels of American foreign policy, there is a sophisticated understanding or awareness of the potential for blowback?
Not to the degree that is needed. I think there's a realization to a certain extent. But even if that realization would be stronger, it is not sufficient in and of itself to bring about change. To bring about change, you need to have political pressure. You need to have political space. You need to make sure that the sentiments of the American public that currently are overwhelming opposed to these endless wars and a foreign policy that is dragging the US into one conflict after another, that is actually channeled to Washington in such a way that it actually does bring about those deeper changes. Right now, the way that it is channeled, the way that it's manifested, is that it has created a situation in which every politician, not every, but almost every politician that wants to run for higher office expresses his or her opposition to endless war. We saw that on the Democratic stage, for instance, in this last primary. Almost all of them did so, Joe Biden himself included. On the Republican side, we saw that that actually became the winning card back in 2016. When Donald Trump railed against the Iraq war, etc. So it's clear where the public is, and it's clear that the politicians speak to those issues during elections. But in between elections, we're not seeing enough change because the public is not present in those discussions. It has not managed to yet find its way and look at specific targets and mobilize around those targets and those decisions. That is needed. So there's a lot of work for advocacy organizations and others to be able to do to tap into that energy. But the energy is there, and the energy is not, it's not surprising that it's there. After 20 years of these endless wars and an entire generation that feels that it's going to have a lower standard of living than the previous generation, much as a result of these wars. Think about it this way. It's not surprising to me that we see more and more polls show that younger Americans no longer have that belief in American exceptionalism, something that really was a cornerstone of the foreign policy that we have pursued in the past. It is not surprising to me because if you are 25 years old right now, throughout your entire life, the United States has engaged in unwinnable wars that are unnecessary and that has made America less safe. After that experience, it's really difficult to hold on to the belief of American exceptionalism or the belief that the U.S. is the answer to every problem of the world.
Yeah, and I note Inet has a grantee, Linda Bilmes, who's written a book with Joe Stiglitz and then done subsequent research for us on the tremendous costs related to post-traumatic stress disorder and other issues in the health budget that, say, an Iraq war lasted, what, a couple, 3 years officially, but the tail of expenses related to health obligations associated with soldiers and people that were involved is enormous. And so I think the scale of the costs added up all are not usually acknowledged. But I think you're making a deeper point, which is what was the purpose to incur those costs is also very questionable. And as you said, many times unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean, if there actually was a threat picture that justified this foreign policy, then the cost the United States would have to accept for pursuing that foreign policy to defend itself, I think would be justifiable. So it's not a pure cost argument. I think the cost argument is a secondary argument. If there really was a major threat for the United States that it had to meet, then obviously the cost would be secondary, and whatever was needed to defend the U.S. would be justified. But here we have a situation in which the very policy itself, regardless of the cost issue is an added problem to it, but in and of itself is unnecessary and unhelpful and counterproductive because it has dragged us into all kinds of conflicts. It has not made us more safe. Just take a look at the Middle East. 1998, there were 5 armed conflicts in that region. By 2019, there were 22. And that is all during the period in which the United States is the de facto military hegemon of the region. Does not mean in any way, shape, or form that all of those conflicts are the fault of the United States. Not at all. However, the most important conflict that gave birth to many of those other conflicts was entirely the fault of the United States, and that was the invasion of Iraq. And the invasion of Iraq was in many ways the apex of the manifestation of this policy of believing that we need to dominate regions in order to make ourselves safe. The mere fact that there was a horrible dictator like Saddam Hussein in that region was a threat to us. So we had to change all of those regimes. We had to invade. We had to dominate. And the first thing we did in Iraq was to build all of these different military bases, expanding this empire. We needed to do this in order to keep ourselves safe. That was the argument. And it's done exactly the opposite. It was unnecessary in the first place. That war was based on a lie. And we had all the different ways of being able to contain Saddam Hussein, which ultimately would have also led to 500,000 Iraqis not getting killed. It would not in any way, shape, or form have been an ideal situation. But the world is not an ideal world. We have to deal and manage the problems that existed without going down the path of thinking that we actually can fix everything and turn the world into our own image. And the very belief that we have to turn the world into our image in order to make ourselves safe is exactly why we have ended up making ourselves less safe.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned Eisenhower's concern about the, what you might call, cancerous growth of a military-industrial complex and refracting our sense of social purpose and our use of resources. I sense that there is a war on the horizon. It's not against a human enemy, but it's against what you might call the fossil fuel industry and the burning of carbon, the consuming of carbon, that requires something that's analogous to a war mobilization. And just as we're having difficulty, what you might call, weaning ourselves from the power of economic sustenance in some corners for making these warlike products, we are also, how would I say, not weaning ourselves of carbon-producing forms of energy and not mobilizing, as Seth Klein, the older brother of the famous activist and writer Naomi Klein, has recently written in what he calls The Good War, using the analogy of war preparation for World War II in Canada to describe the kind of changes of mind and practices of governance that will be necessary to meet the climate challenge. Well, in your case, I'm interested as you see that climate challenge on the horizon, and particularly through the lens of the relationships between the United States and China and the need for global cooperation in meeting that challenge. How do you envision, with your knowledge of foreign policy and, tensions between nations and the practices of the United States, how do you envision we are going to meet the challenge of climate change? And what are the necessary changes that you would recommend?
Well, climate change, I think, is one of the strongest arguments and the most valid reasons as to why we have to rethink our foreign policy. A foreign policy of military domination is a foreign policy that does not create the space necessary for the type of human collaboration that is needed in order to meet common threats such as climate change. And for climate change, we're going to need a degree of human collaboration that is unprecedented in human history. This is part of the reason I am very worried, and the Quincy Institute is very worried about the trajectory of US-China relations. Here you have the two biggest carbon emitters in the world. If they end up in this traditional great power competition and securitize every aspect of their relationship, then we may win that war, but we will lose this planet, because there is no way that we'll be able to have the type of collaboration needed in order to address climate change if the United States and China are entangled in a Cold War at the same time. In fact, if Cold War and confrontation with China becomes the organizing principle of American foreign policy going forward, the impact that will have on everything else in the US's foreign policy making is going to be such that there simply will not be any space for dealing with pandemics or climate change, because it means that we will have an even more bloated Pentagon budget. It will mean that on all of these other things that we need to shift, we will not shift. In, for instance, if we end up in a Cold War with China, regions that Washington have started to realize are no longer that strategically important. I mean, you will hear a lot of people in Washington admit that the Middle East no longer is that important to the United States. The shale oil revolution and many other factors have simply changed the geostrategic picture in such a way that the Middle East is not that significant any longer. However, if we are in a Cold War with China, then every corner of the world risks becoming the battlefield between the United States and China. And then we're back to square one, because now suddenly the Middle East is important again. Because if we don't dominate it, the Chinese will dominate it. That will be the argument. So when we see this push towards a Cold War with China, it does seem to me that it actually is specifically designed to make sure that there cannot be any revisions, certainly no deep revisions, to U.S. foreign policy. We will keep on bloating the Pentagon budget. We will keep on going down the path that we have been going down to on for the last couple of decades. And it's terribly worrisome because by now it should be quite clear that the real challenges we're facing are not other nation states. Ultimately, the existential threats we're facing are planetary. And that, again, I want to emphasize, it does not mean that we don't have real challenges with China. We have great, huge challenges that all need to be dealt with. There is no reason, however, to securitize all of those different challenges. If we have issues when it comes to IP theft and other things, we can find ways to deal with that through proper diplomacy. There's no reason to securitize those issues and turn it into a great power competition.
Well, I see, how would I say, that's almost like, let's go you and I fight and then we'll all die because of another cause. And it's a dreadful scenario to consider. And obviously, some of the less developed countries, like in India, for instance, are going to need support from the wealthier countries collectively to accomplish both their own economic development, health systems, and transformation of an energy structure. And the United States and China will be central to that collaboration and essentially, how would I say, it won't happen without their collaboration, is my estimation. Let me come back to we've been talking a little bit about what you might call addiction to a certain way of thinking, addiction to a certain what you might call allocation of government budget for certain sectors. But one of the things that I sense, and this is kind of in the realm of work like Naomi Oreskes on the Merchants of Doubt and so forth, is that in a period when so many things are seemingly unsound, like as the pandemic has, what I would say, unmasked a lot of the fault lines and flaws in society, it's quite natural for anxiety and fear to be heightened. Is it possible in that tumultuous environment to convince people to de-escalate in the military sector, where what I'm alleging, I suppose, is that the military represents a drive towards self-protection and security, and will the publicists in that realm, the Merchants of Doubt, be inclined to try to, you might call, suggest we are being reckless by transforming our fiscal capacity away from this large, as you said, 800 base military apparatus? And how can that be counteracted, where you may call the fear of that might be even greater than the fear of transforming that?
It's without a doubt going to be a challenge. And then I think our political system is such that we will not see anything of this kind be done proactively in and of itself without massive political pressure from the public. And it requires a tremendous amount of education, because instinctively people will think that a lower Pentagon budget is going to make them less safe. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done here in order to be able to educate the public and create the right type of political pressures, because all it is just reallocation and redefinition of our priorities here. If we lived in a world again in which those type of nation state threats were so significant that it required this type of a Pentagon allocation, then that would be a different story. It's not, again, an argument on the cost side in and of itself. It's in relationship to what the actual threat picture looks like and the nature of that threat. And the nature of the threat is just dramatically different now than it was before. The challenges with these situations is that we can either try to make it happen somewhat proactively before we actually strike a disaster, or we will just have to wait for this disaster to strike before the political will is mustered to do something about it. The work that we're doing at Quincy is trying to do the former, of being able to bring about enough pressure and ideas in order to be able to change things before it becomes so bad as what we are forced to change, so that we actually take advantage of the ability to be able to do this proactively without incurring the most disastrous elements of the cost. In our view, we already have incurred a tremendous amount of unnecessary cost, but there's much, much more pain, unfortunately, out there waiting for us if we don't do this fast enough.
Well, I must say, I personally, having worked for about 7 years in Washington, D.C. in the United States Senate, I spent time working with each party, with the Budget Committee with Pete Domenici on the Republican side, and then with Bill Proxmire on the Banking Committee. I attended an awful lot of what you might call private closed-door caucuses. I saw, as they say, I guess Bismarck said, no one should ever see how sausage or legislation are made. And I have not been to a sausage factory, but I understand the analogy. And I see the work that you're doing, and I see the time that we're in. And I guess, well, how would I say? I enjoy talking with you and how you illuminate these things and the challenges. I encourage everybody to sign in and follow the Quincy Institute. But what I'm really saying is I admire the courage with how you and your colleagues are choosing to spend your life. There's a great deal in fearful times of resistance to change. And you all are stepping out on a stage and helping us see the light in a really critical domain. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate that courage, that insight, that intellect, and the organization you all have put together to bring it to bear on the American mind, and the world's mind, for that matter. Thank you.
Thank you so much for those kind words and for giving me the opportunity to come on and discuss these issues with you.
Talk again soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.